Chariot Solutions TechCast for Thursday, April 3rd, 2008. This episode of the TechCast is sponsored by Drexel University's iSchool, the College of Information Science and Technology. Learn more at www.ischool.drexel.edu. On the show today, Rails 101. This is a presentation from last week's Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise Conference. Chariot Solutions CTO Aaron Mulder walks beginning users through the Rails framework. This week's podcast relies heavily on the presentation itself. You can find it as a PDF file on Chariot's website. Browse to www.chariotsolutions.com, then click on the Java Lab. You will find Rails 101 in the list of presentations from March 26, 2008. I have also provided a link in the RSS feed. So, pause the TechCast, download the PDF, and follow along.
Okay, welcome. I'm going to try to get things underway here. I caught some of you as you were entering the room, but who here has Ruby or Rails experience? A lot? A little? Some? Most of you are pretty new to this, is that right? Okay. So in this talk, I'm going to be kind of giving an overview of Rails 2 specifically, which is the current version now. They came out with Rails 2 not too long ago. And I'm not going to go too much into the Ruby syntax. You'll see it, and I'll point it out. I'm going to try to not to explain it in detail because I've got a lot to get through. But if we have time at the end, you can certainly ask me questions, or if you want to stop me along the way just because something doesn't make any sense, that's fine. But what I'm going to try to do is give a talk that goes from the back to the front, how to talk to the database, how to put your business logic together. Okay, I'll try to speak up. I'm going to try to go through the database, the business logic, how to put the views together, kind of the whole model view controller architecture. I'm not really going to do a lot of Rails evangelism. I'll confine that to the first couple slides. You can find that stuff out on the web. You can find tutorials about building a real app with your manager sitting there over your lunch break or whatever. But I'm going to try to give you enough background that when you sit down and start working through some code on your own, you will have seen things before and it'll make some sense. So this is my token evangelism. Why Rails compared to PHP? You get a little more structure and separation. You get a little more power. There are more features and plugins and libraries available. It's a more advanced programming environment. But on the other hand, if you compare it to Java and J2EE, it's a lot slimmer, less code, less configuration. So the goal, I guess, is to be kind of that happy medium. Now, it doesn't solve every problem, but the problems it solves, it does quite a good job for. So, we're going to go through and hopefully give you an idea of what those problems are and, how to get up to speed with Rails on your own. So some things that you should know coming in, there is a lot of code generation in Rails. You won't be writing all the code. You'll be using tools that'll emit some code, and then you'll go customize that. So that'll save you a little time. Sometimes what happens is if you generate the code and then advance your Rails a couple dot releases, and then you generate something similar, the code that gets generated will be a little different. So that may be something that you'll have to deal with. But generally speaking, it's saving you a lot of time writing the actual code, and we'll see some examples of that. Another point is convention over configuration. Rails is big on not making you explicitly configure every last bit. They would rather make some assumptions. If you're okay with those assumptions, you just skip right by it. So that's part of how it saves code and saves configuration compared to things like Java and J2EE, which tend to have very verbose configuration. And another thing, there are some Rubyisms in here. There are some things that won't make a lot of sense if you don't know Ruby, or that as you get more familiar with Ruby, you'll appreciate the power of them more. You'll see a couple in the slides, and if you look at the actual Rails source code, you'll see a lot of them. So, Rails is actually kind of an interesting way to learn Ruby. It was how I did it. Other people come from a Ruby background and have a different experience. But the last point on here is don't repeat yourself. Again, compared to Java or J2E, you don't want to be doing the same thing over and over and over, putting the same boilerplate in every class file or every configuration file. And again, that's part of why these code generators are there, to save you from some of that effort. So, to get started with Rails, one of the issues is there aren't very many OSs out there that include a working Rails environment. Mac OS Leopard 10.5 shipped with a Rails environment, but then it was immediately outdated because they shipped with Rails 1.2 and then Rails 2.0 came out. It's one of the closer ones that you can just do some upgrades and some of the fundamental tools are there. It has a good Ruby, a good version of Ruby, a good current version of Ruby. It has Ruby gems, which are some of the things you need to install the rest of this stuff. But on Windows, you can get an instant Rails kit where you download it and it'll install all the stuff for you, and that's not bad. On Linux or Mac, I think you're better off trying to work through a process of installing these things on your own. And there are blogs that have exhaustive details. I think the Apple site has one or refers to one. There are a couple blogs out there. So the bottom line is, if you're going to be going through some of this manual stuff, just make sure when you open your command line tools or when you configure your IDE or whatever that your path is set right to get the right versions of all these. But once your Rails is set up and running, it's very easy to get started. The first command to create a project is just Rails project name, and this is the code generation in action. It produces all of this. It produces your project directory. There are commands in there to start the web server. There's a skeleton of the configuration files. It points to a database you can use that's right there. It has placeholders for everything you'll need in your project. So you start with nothing. It creates the subdirectory, fully populates it, and you're ready to go. So that's code generation. Now, the kind of example app that I used for this is, to track a conference where you have people attending and there are sessions they attend and you could rate the sessions and things like that. So you'll see some of that in kind of my slideware examples. But generally speaking, to start with Rails, just Rails and the project name, and it starts generating code and off you go. So what does it actually create? There's an app subdirectory that holds the application-specific code and views. So the business logic, what's going to be the screens for the application, things like that. There's a config directory that points to the database, talks about how to map URLs to specific application functions. There's a DB directory that has scripts to create and populate the database. And it can also hold the database files themselves. The default configuration of Rails comes with SQLite, which is a database that just runs right out of the project directory, so it'll store its database files there. If you have code you want to include in your project that's not really specific to this application, you can put it in a lib directory, or you could put it in plugins, which go in the vendor directory. There's a public directory for static content, HTML pages or images or JavaScripts or whatever. Typically go the script directory then is scripts you run to start your web server, to run the code generation tools, to install plugins, things like that. And the test directory you'll put your tests in, and the vendor directory has plugins you've installed. So we'll see all of these things in action, and hopefully it'll make a little more sense. Now, one last point kind of before we really get into it. There are a number of IDEs or editors that have Rails support or Ruby support. Everyone who has a Mac loves TextMate, except me. I don't really like it for whatever reason. I think it's just because I came from a Java background and some of the functions I'm expecting don't work like I expect. But if you have a Mac, try TextMate. There are a number of IDEs built specifically for dynamic languages or for Ruby, and I've listed a couple here. There are also some Java IDEs that now have Ruby support, actually pretty much all of them. Eclipse, NetBeans, JEdit, IntelliJ, they have varying levels of support. Some of the things you'll find if you're coming from a Java background is that code completion can be a little dicey and navigation can be a little dicey. Because it's a dynamic language, just because you declare an object of some type doesn't guarantee which methods that object will have. Some of them could have been added at runtime or removed, or it could really have mixed in different functions from some other class. So, the thing to look for in a good IDE is to get that sort of stuff as good as possible, code completion and navigation. And in fact, I talk a little, why would you even want an IDE? I mean, a lot of people will say, all you need is a good text editor. Well, an IDE can do things like a text editor can do, syntax highlighting, indentation. It can also do things that the text editors may not do, code completion and navigation, debugging, give you maybe a better view of the project or or break the project down by components so it can show you all the views and all the models and all the controllers without you having to necessarily navigate specific directories. So, you know, I tend to favor using an IDE, but again, I came from a Java background. If you come from a PHP background or whatever, you may prefer a text editor. You know, both can work. All right, so now we'll get started, and I'm again going from the back to the front. So starting at the back end, Rails expects you to have three databases configured, a development database, a test database, and a production database, and they each have a specific role. The development database is where you'll do your day-to-day development work. The test database is where all the tests run, so if you run unit tests or integration tests, they run against the test database, and the production database is obviously for when you move your app into production. So if you look at the very first configuration file for the Rails system, it'll have three databases defined, and you can customize those as you please. You have to be careful, though. You can't just say, well, I have a simple setup. I'm going to, you know, make my one database do all three. That will disappoint you when you first run your tests, and it wipes the whole test database and tries to restore it from development, and you'll discover that your database is gone. So, you know, it is wise to work with this pattern, but again, you can use SQLite, which it ships with, for development or test. If you just want something, you know, very lightweight that runs out of the box on your machine, you don't want to bother with installing a database product. For the longest time, MySQL was, you know, the database product of choice. Now it's kind of SQLite, at least that comes out of the box. But, you know, all kinds of databases are supported. You know, MySQL and Postgres on the open source side, you can get Oracle or SQL Server or whatever. So sometimes you'll have to install a database driver specifically, in addition to what comes with Rails out of the box. I think it may come with SQLite, Postgres, and MySQL out of the box, and the others you have to install as plugins, but that's not such a big deal. So the configuration file where these databases defined is in the config directory, and it's called database.yml. And this is what it looks like. So this is a format we'll talk about in a second, but it's got definitions for these three database environments, development, test, and production, and some settings for each one. This is what it looks like out of the box with a SQLite configuration, and this is what it would look like if you had, you know, a MySQL production database or whatever. You know, each product has slightly different settings. You know, they may have a host name or a schema or, you know, whatever the database product requires. But, you know, it's a very simple notation. You have the, you know, the property name, a colon, and the value. Property name, colon, and the value. And this kind of hierarchy where you have the top level named ones, development, test, and production, and then settings within that. So in fact, this file format has a name, YAML, or for the .yml files. I think it technically stands for yet another markup language. But, you know, again, it's pretty easy to understand. We'll use this also for test data. That's the other main area besides the database configuration. But you can embed dynamic values in there as well. So this is an actual Ruby call. You're getting the current time, time.now, and inserting that as one of the keys. You could have whatever you want, method calls or string concatenation or whatever, if you need to, as well as just fixed constants. And when you go and reference one of these YAML files, you can pull out the entries by name. So we could ask for another entry if this was test data. Yeah. Your database is set up the right way. So if your database is set up the way Rails expects, you need the green code. If it's not, you may need to add something like the red code. So you can see just in setting up, this is a model, and we'll talk more about them in a bit, but there's a lot more code and configuration here if your database is, you know, if it's a legacy database. So if you have a new database, that's very fortunate. You can use a feature called migrations, which are very nice. You can write your database definition in a very simple syntax, and Rails can apply that to any database product. So that makes it easy to have SQLite in development and MySQL in production or Oracle in production or whatever. So there are some little bits that still need you to write SQL statements, but the vast majority of it is a nice portable syntax. And then on top of that, you get versioning. So every database, every chunk of database script has a version number, and you can upgrade your database to the newest version, and it'll just go through and apply all the differences between whatever version it was at and the current version. Or you can roll back, and we'll see how that works. So that's very useful if you get an app into production, and then you later go to update it, you can just migrate to the current version of the database, and it'll apply any schema changes, any SQL statements it needs to execute to update the data. You know, it can add and remove columns, whatever the case may be. And all you have to do is say db migrate, it goes to the current version by executing all those scripts. This is a migration, so this would be one of those numbered scripts. And it has an up and a down method. And the up gets executed when you're going up to that version or past it, and the down gets executed when you're going down that version or past it. So the syntax here is all Ruby and Ruby method calls. These are actually method calls. So this create table kind of has invisible parentheses here if you're coming from the Java background. This is an argument. And then it's using something called a block. And the block is between the do and the end here. And it basically is saying I'm using a block with a variable called table, and that's going to get provided, and then I'm going to call all these methods on the table variable. So this is one of the Rubyisms that will probably not make a lot of sense until you've used it a little, and I apologize for that. But you know, basically, just think of table as some argument that this gets passed and can do things with. So it's calling the column method on that table object several times, and you know, again, we have kind of the imaginary parentheses, and these are arguments. So we're saying, you know, create a table, and on that table create columns, and this is the name of a column, this is the data type, and then we have some optional arguments after that. So whether it's nullable, whether it has a column size, things like that. So, you know, this is your migration code. There's no SQL here. You're not using any database-specific syntax. But then when it goes to execute these migrations, it's going to use a database driver that is defined from that database.yml when you had the adapter name. That identifies the driver. And again, if it's not an open source driver, you may have had to install that driver as a plugin. But that driver knows how to execute a create table statement with the right syntax, or a drop table, or an alter table, or whatever. So when this is executed, it gets converted by the driver into the product-specific syntax, but this is what you maintain. It's, you know, it's portable, it's in that Ruby syntax. You can even make it more abbreviated than this. There's a way to say, I want the following columns to be string columns and then list five of them. I didn't show that in this slide, but that's known as sexy migrations. You can make this, you know, even briefer and more compact. So, you know, again, you can say, well, is this all that great compared to SQL? I don't know. You could argue that back and forth. But then when you add the versioning in and the fact that you can easily migrate to or from any given version, then it becomes extremely useful. So this is how you run the command to migrate to the current version of the database. You run a tool called rake and give it the db:migrate command, and it's going to run the script. So my first migrate script is number one, create conferences. It's going to run that. It's going to create a table called conferences, as I've set up in that script. You know, I've truncated this because of the slide where it does. I haven't showed all the output. But, you know, let's say that succeeded, and you say, whoops, I made a mistake. I need to roll it back. You run it with a parameter version equals zero, saying you want to roll back to version zero. And then it will run that script again and drop the table. So that's how easy it is to move up or down to specific versions of your database based on these these migration scripts.
I have questions.
Yeah. Okay, so the first question, to answer the first question first, most of what I'm talking about here today uses a product called Active Record, or a library called Active Record that's database oriented, and is, I guess I'm answering both your questions, is kind of like what Hibernate is. It is an ORM mapping layer. It has caching features and things like that. So we'll see what those model objects look like that map to the database, and you'll get an idea of that. Ruby has XML features. It doesn't, you know, Active Record doesn't deal directly with XML persistence. You can create objects from XML. You can emit XML from objects. I haven't used, you know, a pure XML storage system myself, so I don't really know if you could, like, query a group of XML, you know, query across XML objects like you can a database. You might want to look at see if there's a plugin that, you know, behaves like Active Record for a directory of XML files or something like that. So we just saw this command rake db migrate, and I'm going to talk just a little bit about what rake is. It is kind of the equivalent of make for Rails, people say, but you know, I don't know that that's really true. It's really just a tool that has a bunch of useful tasks. So one of those tasks is db.migrate. Another one we'll see later when you set up your URL paths. There's a task rake routes that'll show you all the URL paths that are configured. They're tasked to, you know, create or drop a database. They're tasked to run unit tests or integration tests. There are all these different tasks, and you can see what's available by saying rake dash dash tasks. So when you install, you know, your Rails project, you'll then probably be using rake, just running it out of the project directory for a number of different things. So, you know, the syntax rake task arguments like rake db colon migrate, and then any arguments like version equals 3 or whatever. And you can write your own rake tasks if you find things that, you know, rake doesn't do, that you don't want some other, you know, script set up. It's just kind of a project maintenance thing. You know, maybe it's one of your own maintenance tools or something. You can put them in libtasks. Okay, so now we'll talk about the DB models and what Active Record contributes. So a DB model is a Ruby object, and it does not have getters and setters. It does not have instance variables, which is a little confusing if you're coming from a Java background. You don't see that stuff. You can't code complete it, but it's there. So what happens is when you're dealing with one of these model objects, you can call methods for every property in the database. So if you have a first name property, there's a first name method. If there's a first name column in the database, there's a first name method you can call. You can set it or get it. If there's a last name, you can set last name or get last name, you know, and so on for all the properties in the database. And it uses some Ruby magic to make this work. What Ruby allows you to do is if someone calls a method on that object and no such method exists, it lets you actually define handling for the call for the method to the method that doesn't exist. And it uses that to intercept your calls to methods that don't exist on these model objects and do something. So you can call methods for all the database columns and they will work. But if you look at the source code, they're not there. So, you know, that's one of these weird things. But it means you don't have to write all that code. You don't have to write getters and setters or private instance variables. You don't have to run a tool that will spew them out from the database. They're automatically up to date at every moment because, you know, it synchronizes what's in the database with what properties it'll respond to on the objects. So, you know, it is a little weird, but as you see more and more of the power of this, it's really hard to not appreciate it. I guess particularly we'll see some of the finding and querying capabilities and summing and things like that just kind of work automagically. So that's one of the great things about dealing with a database in Rails. But the first thing you need to do is actually generate one of these models to correspond to the database table, maybe a table you made with that migration. And so you can create it by hand, but we'll look at creating it with one of the code generation tools. So in the script directory, there's this generate tool. So typically the way you run code generation once the project is created is script generate something. And we're going to script generate a model called conference. And so it's going to create all these files for us. Some directories, it says, okay, they already exist, but it's going to create a model object under app models. It's going to create a unit test. It's going to create some test data. It's going to create a migration. So these are the things I'll talk about right at the moment. But you know, it's going to create code generate that stuff for you, and then you can just go customize it. So the script generate tool, you know, we just saw how it's used to generate a database model, the migration, the database model, plus some test features. We'll later see using script generate to generate the front end as well. And you can install various Rails plugins that add generation options, new code generators. So if you install a security plugin, RESTful Authentication, then it has code generation options along with it and things like that. So the typical syntax is script generate, and then whatever generator you want it to run, and then whatever you want the class name to be, and then any other arguments. So script generate, we're generating a model and associated things, and we want the class name to be conference. And then in this case, some of the other arguments you can pass are properties you want to set up on that model. So we could say we want the conference to have a name, which is a string, a starts on, which is a date, could have a location, things like that. So you know, you can pass those additional properties, and they'll get populated into the code that's generated. So that's even less for you to write. So when it generates the migration for you, you know, it'll populate those right into the migration. So I'm just showing again, you know, the output of the script generate. If you don't give it any additional field names, you know, you'll get all the same files. They'll just be a little emptier, but you get the model, the test data, and the migration. So this is the model, the very empty model. And, you know, again, you don't see any getters or setters here. You don't see any finders or anything like that, because that all will just work automatically. So some of the things we will put in here are some validation. You could put in your own business logic and things like that. But this is a valid model, these two lines. So when you want to create a new one of these model objects, if you want to create a new conference object, you use the new method. Or then once you go to save it, you can use the save method. And if you want to do both at once, you can use the create method. So create will instantiate it with the properties you provide and save it all at the same time. So there are two versions of the create and save, one with an exclamation point at the end and one not. If you call the create or the save with an exclamation and it fails, it throws an exception. If you call the one without the exclamation and it fails, it'll just set various error fields and return false. So more commonly, that's the way it's set up in the Rails code we write, is to call the one that doesn't throw exceptions in an if-then block, so that then you can say, you know, if I successfully created this object, then show the page for that object. Otherwise, go back and show the form with the errors highlighted and things like that. So we'll see some of that. But you know, whichever case happens, the model objects have been changed. So you know, it doesn't like roll back the state of the objects. It may not write to the database, but the bad data is still there. And then if you render the form again, you can see the bad entry and then the text next to it saying, you know, invalid syntax for a telephone number or whatever the error was. Now, one of the clever things is, instead of having to have a specific list of arguments, you know, first name, comma, last name, comma, age, comma, address, or whatever, you can pass a hash, which is like a Java map, of property values to set on the new object. So its constructor essentially can take a hash of name equals Aaron, first name equals Aaron, last name equals Mulder, email equals whatever, and so on and so forth. And Rails uses that to actually simplify handling forms from web pages. So we'll see how that works a little later too. So this is typically, you know, what you see if you look at some of the web tier code for creating a new object. In this case, a new person. If you first, the new method there is going to ultimately render an empty form that the person can fill out. And then once they fill it out and hit submit, it'll go to the create method. So in the new method, we create a new person object that's empty or has whatever defaults that person object specifies. And then we'll populate the form off that. Once the form is submitted to the create method, it gets the parameters from that form in this params variable. So it's just passing that params variable to the person.new. And if you were to inspect this, you'd see it's a hash with name value pairs for all the fields in the form. So first name, last name, and so on and so forth. So this is, you know, taking advantage of that fact, you can just pass a hash to a constructor. And then the next thing it's going to do with that person is call the save without the exclamation point. And if it works, then they've been saved to the database and we can redirect to a person page. If it doesn't work, we're going to redirect back to the form page, which is essentially going back to this new method or rendering what this new method would have rendered. And then you'll see the original form again, and it'll have the errors highlighted. And you know, to your point earlier, one of the features new in Rails 2, or you know, newish, is that you know XML is a kind of top level citizen as far as the output goes. So you have you know the standard option is to render in HTML, but if the client for whatever reason submitted or asked for a response in XML. That's supported as well with similar syntax.
I have a question here, actually.
Yeah.
If you have to do validations, do you have to do any client-side scripting over here?
The validations, let me show you. We'll get to the validations in a minute. In fact, the next slide. But the way the validations typically work is they happen during the save operation. So when the save goes off, it's going to run through all the validations and set various errors. And then at this point, it re-renders the screen if there were errors and pulls out those messages and assigns them to the specific fields. Now, it's very easy to do that in Ajax, you know, so it's not resubmitting the whole screen, but it typically doesn't emit JavaScript to do the validation. So there is a trip to the server involved. You could add that JavaScript, but it's not the way that the kind of out-of-the-box Rails validation works. Okay, so it determines that based on the URL that was used. For example, if you were the typical URL to get to a person web page would be localhost:3000/people. And if you want it in an XML, you'd say localhost:3000/people.xml. And just by noticing that URL has a .xml on the end, it's going to then decide it should be using the XML renderer instead of the HTML renderer.
Oh, so those two could be mutually exclusive.
Yeah, they are, in fact. So it's basically saying if the format of this request is HTML, do this.
Oh.
If it's XML, do that. And if the save failed and the format is XML, do this, or HTML, do this, and XML, do that. So it's going to do one or the other based on what the current request is looking for. And it determines that based on the URL you use to come in, typically. And you can do that for more than XML. You can use that to, you know, have an iPhone, you know, version of your site that has different HTML or whatever. You can set up different output formats. Okay, so the validation, there are loads of validation helper methods, and we'll see what a model with validation looks like on the next slide. But validate presence of is going to ensure that some particular field was submitted. Validate length of, you can, you know, give it a min and max. Validate confirmation of, used to make sure that the original password and the password confirmation match, and so on and so forth. There are like 10 or 20 of these. And here's the URL if you want to look up all the different validations that you can do. So you put those on the model object, and they get invoked automatically when you save that model object or when you create, which kind of does the save under the covers.
Can you write your own custom validation?
Yeah, so each of these validations is actually just a method in Ruby. It doesn't necessarily look like it. I mean, one of the things with Ruby is sometimes method calls don't always look like it, but you could write your own methods and use them in the same way. So this is a model, a person model, and instead of being two lines, we've buffed it out with all these validations. So, you know, username and email are required, the password has to match the confirmation, the email has to match this giant regular expression, which is actually valid, but I just pulled it off the web somewhere. The username and email have to be unique, you know, ignoring case sensitivity, and all this stuff. So, you know, you put in all these validations, and suddenly, without any additional work, your web interface gets a bunch of additional functionality. You know, it'll pop up saying, your password length must be between 4 and 40, or email is required, or whatever. It'll highlight things in red. And you can, you know, you can override the CSS styles that it uses out of the box if you want to have, you know, if you don't want them highlighted in red, but you want the text to be bold or something like that. So, you know, a lot of that power comes right from specifying these validations on your model. One of the other powerful features of Active Record is the finding or querying capability. So you can use find and give it an ID defined by primary key, but you can also construct a find method that has, you know, any combination of property names in it. So find by first name would say you're looking for one record and this is a first name. Find all by first name or last name says you're expecting a group of records and here's the value. You can say find by first name and last name or find by first name and email address or whatever. If you don't want to do it that way, you can say call find where the first argument is either, you know, indicates whether you want one or many results. And then you can have conditions that use parameter substitution to avoid SQL injection and things like that. You can get as complex as you want with this. So, you know, on top of this, when we talk about relationships, when objects have relationships, you can then call finders on those relationships and things like that. So there's very, very powerful features. You know, I really don't have time to do it justice, but it's magic what you can do with finding and querying objects based on Active Record. So the relationships are also declared on the models like the validations. Now, if you have a one-to-one relationship, one of the models will have a has one declared on it, and the other one will have a belongs to declared on it. And that basically depends on which table in the database has the foreign keys. A one-to-many, one model will have a has many, and one will have a belongs to. If it's a many-to-many, they'll both have a has and belongs to many. So a user has an address. So on the user model, or a person rather, has an address. On the person model, we'd see a has many declaration, and on the address model, we'd see a belongs to. So person has many addresses, address belongs to person, or something like that. You can also have something called through. So if we have a person who attends sessions at a conference, then they have a relationship to the speakers whose sessions they attended. So, you know, the person may have a relationship to the session table, and the session may have a relationship to the speaker table, so you can say person has a relationship to speaker through session. So you get these kind of indirect relationships. Now, you can do some customizing if your code doesn't, if your database doesn't comply with the Rails assumptions about how the foreign keys are structured and things like that, but you can also say sort ordering. You can have conditions, so you say, you know, this particular relationship should only have the sessions, you know, that happened on Monday or whatever. Now, when you create one of these relationships, you get a property on your model object that's an array type property with the name of the relationship. So just like you can query first name, you can query an array called sessions on a person object. And then once you get to that variable or that property for the relationship, you can use find methods on that. So I could say, you know, I could get a person, I could say person.sessions.find, you know, date after 10 o'clock, or, you know, start time after 10 o'clock, or something like that. You can do sums on them. So I could say, you know, person.sessions.sum, you know, the time they were in the session, and say this person was in sessions for 4 hours today, or something like that. So, you know, there's a lot of power, again, on what you can do to those relationship properties, as well as just to the models themselves. So this is an example of relationship. Again, person has many addresses, address belongs to person. This is all the declaration you really need, but you could have more, again, you know, if you wanted to sort them, or, you know, you needed to override what the foreign keys look like, or, you know, you wanted to have a relationship that only held home addresses and a different one that held work addresses or something like that. So this is how you could use it. You could say, create a new person, and I'll call that me. Then I'm going to find any addresses, or I'll find the first address of type work. Now I'll create a new address. I'll add that to my addresses array. And then I'll say, who am I? I am address.person. So we've added that to the addresses array, which also set the person on the address. And then we can, you know, print that out. So again, there's some Ruby syntax in here with the at variables, and with, you know, adding things to an array with the double less than and things like that. And, you know, you'll certainly see more of that and get more familiar with it, I think, the more you use this. Again, the active record is kind of set up with the concept of tables or maybe views and not stored procedures. There are ways you can call stored procedures. I don't know how effectively you can set up like a model object on top of a stored procedure. You could certainly use some of the same features, you know, to then, you know, if you had one stored procedure to call to query and one to update, you know, you could set up a similar looking model object. You know, there may be plugins that would let you use the validations on that object or something. I'd have to look into that. I haven't done as much with it myself. Okay, so one of the other tools you can use when working with models, or with any of your Rails code for that matter, is another one of these scripts called Script Console. And if you've done any Ruby work, there's a Ruby tool called IRB that gives you an interactive client where you can then, you know, run things at the command line and try them out. And Script Console does the same thing, but loads your whole Rails environment in there. So any Rails classes, model classes, business logic, anything like that is available. So it's basically just IRB with all your Rails code there. So you can try creating a person object, and again, we're using the syntax where we give it a hash of name value pairs rather than having arguments in some specific order. So username is this, first name is that, last name is that. We're creating the new person, which means we're calling new and save in the same operation. It basically says, okay, I've got a person object. Now I'm making the assumption that that person object got the primary key number one, and I can try to find it with that primary key number one. It'll give me back a person object. I can call the first name method, and that'll, you know, return whatever the first name on that person was, which, you know, matched what was up there. So you know, usually you do something more exciting than just testing out, you know, your basic Finder operation. But you know, you have this script console, you know, at your command to try out the code as you're writing it, just to make sure things work as you expect. So again, just like the IRB that comes with Ruby, and you know, you would typically use this to try things out as you develop them at the command line. And you know, it's a bit tougher to work with your HTTP controller. So once we get to the web level, it's easier to just point a browser at it and see how things go. There is actually a specific debugger that you can use, and some of the IDEs actually have the integration with that. So yeah, you can get that behavior. So talking quickly about unit tests, in that original project directory, there was a test directory. It has a unit test subdirectory. The test data goes in something called fixtures, which are in that YAML format we discussed earlier. And there's typically one fixture for each model or each database table. So it may have a couple rows of test data in it. Now you can run all your unit tests with rake test or rake test units. And they, again, will run against the test database. And the test database is completely flushed. It copies the structure from development. And then the data that's loaded is the fixtures that any particular test requires. So if that test only lists a couple things, a couple fixtures, it'll get a very empty database to run against. You can also have it load all the fixtures just to make sure all the test data is there. But you know, again, each time it starts fresh. So you get, you know, very repeatable behavior. But you know, it may spend a lot of effort doing some, you know, loads and deletes and things like that. But you know, if you code generate some code and then go to customize it, if those tests got generated for you, that's a great way to see if you broke anything by just, you know, making your customizations, then running the tests and make sure that they all still run. And then you can certainly add plenty of your own tests in there and your own test data. So this is what a fixture looks like that has test data. So again, you know, this top part here is an example of the fixture YAML file. So this is people.yaml. We've got two entries in it. You know, we've got a couple of properties listed for each one. Note, I didn't put in a primary key ID, and that'll be taken care of for us. Now, in another YAML file, this is for the addresses test data, I can refer to a person. The address has a relationship to a person, and I can just set it to use person Aaron, which is referring to the person with that name up here. So this is kind of nice that you don't have to deal with primary keys. You don't here have to say primary key is 17, and here say person ID equals 17. You can just refer to things by name in your fixture. So that was new in Rails 2 and certainly welcome, especially if you end up having, you know, several developers working on this stuff simultaneously and using the same IDs and things like that. It would get pretty annoying. So it's a lot easier to use the name-based references. So these are sample fixtures. And this is a sample unit test. So at the top of the unit test, you list which fixtures it needs, or you can just say fixtures colon all, and it'll load all of them. But you know, this would say I want people.yaml and addresses.yaml to be applied to the test database before I run these tests. These are the individual test methods. They're just called test something or other. So this is calling a person finder on a person we defined in that test data, and then asserting that it's equal to a record named Aaron that we also know we set up in the test data. So we're basically just ensuring that finder works, that the, you know, finder finds the row in the test data and matches, you know, this row in the test data. So you get these arrays, people or hashes, I guess, you know, people and addresses based on the fixtures you prepared, and you can refer to those in your test class. The one down here is trying to create a new user and then making sure you can search for that new user and asserting that it's not nil. So, you know, there are various assertions you can use. If you look through some of the integration tests, there are fancier things they do with like mock HTML requests and stuff like that. But, you know, you can put a lot of power into your unit tests and even more into your integration tests. And so, you know, some people like Ruby on Rails a lot because it's so easy to do test-driven development, or at least to make sure you have pretty good test coverage. Now, once you get into that, you may find some arguments over whether the fixtures are the best way to represent test data or not, and there are some other alternatives to that. But that's kind of beyond the scope of the talk. So looking at the front end now, as far as the views and controllers go of the model view controller tier, basically the functionality is a URL from a request comes in and then gets mapped somehow to controller methods and perhaps even arguments to those controller methods. So Rails 2 defaults to the REST style of URLs and mappings. So that means normally your URL will be like slash controller or slash controller slash ID, and then you care which HTTP method is used. So to be specific, if your URL is slash person slash 2 and your HTTP method is get, that's going to go to the person controller, the show method, because it was a get, and it's going to set the parameter called ID to 2. So it's, if we look at the show method of the person controller, we'd expect it to do something with the parameter ID of 2, namely load a specific user that we can then render. If you used a put, that would be different. You know, that would be saying we're trying to update that person instead of show that person. So you would get, you know, the update method instead of the show method being called. So it's, you know, it's doing some fancy things. You know, most web applications historically have only looked at the URL, but Rails has moved and adopted REST where the HTTP method is important as well. Now, once you've decided what controller method to call, you'll get various logic in the controller, and then typically a view is invoked. Typically a view is invoked, and that usually has a name like the controller method name.html.erb. That's basically just saying, well, we'll see what these ERB files look like, but it's saying, you know, this is the HTML we want to produce, you know, so we're going to, in this person controller, when we show a person, we're going to load a person object, and then this is going to say how to translate that into HTML. Is there a question in the back? Okay. So if you want to actually see some of this in action, the easiest thing to do is to use that code generation tool, script generate, and tell it to generate a scaffold, and then give it the name of the model. And what that's going to do is the same thing as if you were generating a model, but it's going to actually include views, controllers, integration tests, style sheets, layouts, and so on and so forth. So it's adding front end. So here's an example. If we say script generate scaffold person, we're going to get a person migration, a person model, person unit tests, a person controller, you know, views to list people, to show a person, to edit a person. We're going to get functional tests, you know, style sheets and all this stuff. So, you know, once you really get into your code, you may find that generating a scaffold is kind of overkill. Like, you may not want new layouts and style sheets for everything, every model object you create. But it's definitely a great idea to do this at least once to make sure that you can see, you know, what the stereotypical implementation looks like. And then you can just copy pieces or use the individual generate targets, like generate a controller and a model separately or something like that. But when you generate that scaffold, you actually get a working website. It doesn't just generate code. You can navigate it with your browser. So again, it'll use the development database. You can just run the script server command to start it up. And by default, it'll be on port 3000, so HTTP localhost colon 3000, and then whatever the name of your model is. So if you generate a model called person, it'll be people. If we generated the conference model, it would be conferences or whatever. So you can point your browser directly to that. You know, you basically generate the scaffold, run the database migration to make sure the database table exists, run the server, point your browser to it, and then you're up and running. You can make the change to the view and reload the page, and you should see it right there. You know, it's one of those advantages over Java: no compiling, no packaging, no WAR files. You just make the changes and they're instantly reflected. So this is kind of the process you often go through. Generate some code, make sure that it, you know, fundamentally looks right, then go edit it, you know, keep reloading and make sure that you're getting the right behavior as you continue to customize it. So at the controller tier, the controller is what has the business logic that's handled when the request, or that's executed when the request is handled. So it may be preparing reference data that's going to be used to present a form. It may be processing a form submission. It may have things like redirecting or executing underlying business logic or whatever. So once the form, once the controller is done with its work, then a view is typically rendered unless you're just going to redirect to something else. And any instance variables declared by the controller method that were called, and they're the variables that have an at sign in the front, are visible to the view. So we'll see what this looks like. This is the same code I showed earlier, that create code. And it's in a controller. So this is the people controller. We've got two methods, new and create. And the new method is declaring one of these at variables. So that's going to be visible to the view. And that's just putting an empty object in it. And then if you were to look at the mapping, you'd find that this new method is called when you have a HTTP GET on the URL /people/new. Now, likewise, once you submit the form that renders, it'll call a create method. So the form gets submitted to /people as a post, and as an HTTP post, or you know, you can do these in XML as well. Then this method is called, and what that's going to do is declare another one of these, you know, it's the same one, but another one of these add variables. It's going to populate the parameters that were submitted from the form into a new person object. Then it's going to try to save that person object, and then it's going to render, you know, if the save worked, it'll render something either HTML or XML in the case of the generated code. Or if the save didn't work, it's going to redirect to, in the case of HTML, redirect to the form again to show the error messages. In the case of XML, it's going to render an XML message that has the various errors in it. So this is kind of the typical flow. You get new, you create an empty object, or maybe an object with some defaults. Maybe you put some reference data in for dropdowns and things like that. The form is rendered. The user fills it out. They submit it. Then create is called. That's going to populate the form data into an object or into several objects and try to save them and take it from there. Well, OK, so you don't need to package as a WAR file. But all the same, you wouldn't want to go into your production server and start editing code right there in the live directories, right? So Capistrano is used, you know, if you check in a new release to Subversion, you know, you can then say push this Subversion release to my production server. Capistrano can do things like apply the database changes that go with the new code and stuff like that. So for those who aren't familiar, Capistrano is a kind of deployment tool for Rails. And you know, its purpose is to kind of encapsulate all the things you want to do together in that process of updating a production server or deploying to a production server. You could just copy stuff over by hand and apply the database migrations by hand and stuff like that, but you probably are better off using a tool like Capistrano that can, you know, deal with tagged Subversion releases or things like that. And yeah, I mean, there are some alternatives to Capistrano, but yeah, you would. Another thing is, often you'll have, I mean, I don't really cover this in the talk, but you may have many mongrel processes running on your production server, and Capistrano can manage those and stuff like that. So, I would definitely encourage you to look into tools like that when it comes time to go to production. Well, so you know, I should say that the way I've used it is mostly SSH. You know, there are probably other alternatives. So this is just an example of some more controller methods. You know, this is the one that's going to render a list of all the people. So it's the default. If you go to /people with a GET request, you'll get a list of all the people. And it's just doing a simple find of everybody. And then it's saying for HTML format, I don't have to do anything in particular. And the default behavior is to call, to render a view that has the same name as the controller method .html.erb. So, you know, no special logic. It's just going to call the default one. For XML, we have to tell it what to render. The show one is to render a particular person where, again, that ID gets passed in from the URL to the controller method. So it's finding the person with that ID and then, you know, rendering a particular view to display that person's details. So what the views look like, the controllers are in the app controllers directory. The views are in the app views directory in a subdirectory based on the controller name. So for the views associated with the people controller, you'd say app views people and then, you know, index.html.erb or show.html.erb or whatever. Yeah. Okay, so these are the URLs that will, I just kind of put them in a comment here, the URLs that will result in this method being called. So if you call /people/14, it'll call this method and turn 14 into this ID parameter. Now if you put a .xml on the end, it's going to do the same thing. It's just going to call the XML renderer instead of the HTML renderer. Right. So that would typically be used, you know, this is what's used if you're pointing a browser to it most typically, and this is what's used if you're pointing a client tool that wants XML for some kind of integration purpose most typically. Okay. So, you know, again, the views go in the app, views, controller name, and then the action. So the new controller action would have a view called new.html.erb, which is what renders the form to create a new person. Create doesn't have a view associated with it because it's either going to redirect, if the create worked, it'll redirect to one page. If it didn't work, it'll redirect back to this form. So there's no view there. The index gets an index.html.erb to show a list of people in the show, a show.html.erb to render a particular person. So what is this html.erb format? It is a regular HTML file with embedded Ruby statements, and we'll see what those look like. Plus, you get a lot of helper methods you can call. So this is an example. If you were viewing a person, this could be your show.html.erb. Again, it's, you know, the structure is typical HTML, table tags, and so on and so forth. The bracket parenthesis is, you know, what's going to escape a block of Ruby code. If you have bracket parenthesis equals, then it's going to emit the output of whatever this statement is. If you don't have the equal sign, it's just going to do something. So if you wanted, you know, an if-then loop, you wouldn't have the equal sign. You'd just have if blah, 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 and then an end one, and then down below you'd have an end. But this is going to actually emit something. That H is a method call that's going to, you know, produce sanitized HTML, again, to prevent against the, you know, cross-site scripting and SQL injection and that sort of thing. So we're calling this helper method H, which is going to sanitize the HTML, and then we're going to put in the username property of the @person object. I mentioned earlier that when the controller defines a variable with an @, an instance variable, in its method, that's visible to the view, and here the view is using it. So the controller method, the show method on the controller, must have, you know, defined this @person, or else the view would blow up. But here we're printing the username, here we're printing slightly more complex, their first name and last name. And then we're using some other helper methods to generate links elsewhere in the application. So link to takes a name for what the link should be called, and then what you want to link to. And in this case, we're using methods peoplePath and editPersonPath that use particular URL routes configured for the application. And I'll talk about that later as well. But sometimes you can just, like if we wanted to just view a person, you could say link to @person, and it would create a link to view that person. So, you know, this is one of those things that's both powerful and frustrating. It's powerful that you can, you know, automatically and very easily create links to a person object, the edit person object, the list, the page that lists all the people, you know, and stuff like that. But on the other hand, it's a little frustrating because you've got to remember what all those things are and what they go to. And, you know, so some days I just want to put the URL in because I know what it is. And, you know, that would be easier. But this is certainly more maintainable, I guess. But again, you can use a rake command to give you the list of, you know, all these shortcuts that you could use if you forget. So they try to make it hard to forget. So, you know, if that person had nested data like, you know, the sessions they've attended, you can use more Rubyisms. This is another one of those blocks where you have a do and end. We're passing in, we're getting the array of all the sessions the person attended. And then for each of those, we're calling this block. And we're passing in the current session to the block. So it can then print out for each session they attended, speaker colon name, session name, or whatever. Now, there are other ways you can do this, and we'll see, you know, some alternatives. But, you know, this is an example of how you can navigate those model objects nested fields. And one of the things to note here is, unlike Hibernate, you won't get an error at this point saying, you know, you failed to navigate this relationship while the object was still in the session of Hibernate or something like that, which is an error I get a lot on the Java side. It drives me batty. But You know, you can navigate any relationship at any time in any part of your Ruby app without worrying about whether you're in the scope of the backend persistence session or something like that. Yeah. No, it's just basically the naming syntax. In Rails 1.2, typically things would be called foo.rhtml, and now they're typically called foo.html.erb, but the contents are the same. Okay, so if we wanted to create a form to actually edit a person, the first thing we have is a helper method to display any error messages up at the top. Then we use the form for helper. We give it the @person, and that knows how to construct a form pointing to the correct URL. And it also knows that when we create form elements down below, it should have those form elements read properties off that person object. So when we say we want to create a text field for first name, it knows that we mean the first name off of that object. Likewise, we have a text field for the last name. We have a submit button where we give it a name. You know, automatically, the error message highlighting is handled. It's going to produce the right CSS styles if there's an error on this field. And it's just up to us to make sure that those CSS styles do the right thing. We got another one of those link things at the end. So, yeah. Based on whether the incoming object had an ID or not, it knows whether it's a new or an update. And then it uses the correct HTTP method, you know, based on the convention. Okay. So I'm actually running out of time. I'm going to have to probably speed through the rest of this and ask you to hold questions, and we can, you know, do some questions out in the hall or whatever. But there is a feature called partials that lets you encapsulate a little bit of a view that will be reused by several other views. It's kind of like JSP includes or something like that. So, you know, you would typically use that if you have several things that want to reuse the same bit of logic. So if we wanted to have a session description, you know, that had always had the same format, we could put that in a partial, and then when we want to show a person, we could just render that partial instead of actually, you know, manually digging through and printing out that data. So, you know, again, you can, you know, use partials for reusable bits of code like that. There are still other form options you can use. There are AJAX options. There are options if you have a form that's not being bound to to one specific object, but is, you know, instead submitting data that will be populated into several objects. You know, I won't go through all that. There are a feature called layouts, and a layout basically gives the template of a page. So it gives the header and the footer, applies the style sheets and the JavaScripts and things like that. There is one HTML.erb that's the default for the whole application, and then each controller can have its own on top of that. And you can even apply layouts to partials if you want. If you want your partial to always come up in a box or something like that. So the scaffold, when you generate a scaffold, it'll generate a layout, and you can see how that works. And I won't cover this last bit in much detail, but routing is how it maps URLs to controllers. So there's a file routes.rb that defines that, and when you run the generation tools, it'll update that. And if you run rake routes, it'll show you basically the meat of what's in there. There's a transaction option if you want to wrap several active record calls in one transaction. It doesn't handle XA transactions, but you can, you know, get the rollback for doing several updates at once against, you know, one data source. As far as security goes, there's not a whole lot of security built in. One of the things that's included is cross-site request forgery defense. So, you know, people can't have automated jobs submitting forms to your site. There is HTTP authentication by default. So you can say this page requires a particular username and password to access it. It's not real fancy. You know, you'd have to write the code if you wanted it to cover users and groups or things like role-based authentication or things like that. So there are plugins that are fancier, like RESTful Authentication is a popular one. It has a code generation to generate a user class with, you know, remember me features, password hashing. It has some code it emits to handle logins to know who the current user is and what roles they have. You know, you can add authorization to particular methods to say, you know, they must have logged in to access this controller, but then in addition, they must be an administrator for this method. So that's a good plugin to check out. There are other plugins to force SSL and things like that. Now, I've mentioned plugins several times. Basically, it's some additional functionality out there that you can easily install into your application. You install it with another one of these scripts, script plugin install, and then a URL that will be provided by the plugin's homepage or whatever. The plugins get installed under vendor plugins, and you know, they can include, again, rake targets, code generation, library code, or anything like that. So you know, once it's installed, you could directly copy it from there to another project, you know, to the other project's vendor directory, but you'd lose any installation script behavior. So usually you just script plugin install it in every project you want to use it in. And you know, things I don't even have time to touch briefly. There are a lot of different web servers you can run Rails through. There are different deployment options. We mentioned Capistrano. Clustering and caching for performance. You know, Rails has adopted this REST style, but I didn't really talk through how you write client code to interact with it. But all the XML capabilities are there. AJAX features, I didn't really cover email. I mean, I could have given a 4-hour or an 8-hour talk probably going through all this stuff. But, you know, hopefully this gives you enough background that, you know, once you start getting into it and trying some things out, you'll kind of know where you stand and what's what and where to look from there. All right, I think I probably shouldn't take questions. We should probably wrap this up and let the next group come in, but I'll be out in the hall if you want to talk more, okay? Thanks.